but I want it to change. Okay, it's I see we're still missing certain people, but it's already 9 o'clock on my computer, so it's time to begin. This is the last class of the semester on Rosh Shlomo Yosef Zevin. We won't finish with him. We'll pick up with him, I guess, probably one more class, God willing, when we start again. Before we start, just a few things left over from last time. You know, I told this whole story about my family's connection to Rav Zevin. You know, people like me, we feel pride in this, that, you know, this great sage lived in my grandfather's house, and there was a connection to the family, not so much to my grandfather, who was young, but my great-grandfather, my grandfather's brother, the one I mentioned last week, the communist, told me about when he went to Jerusalem, and, you know, he got together with Rav Zevin. So I use these as a line often when I'm with Chabad people. And three times something has happened. Two of these times, the person was a Baal Tshuva, the Shliach. Or actually, no, once he was a complete Baal Tshuva, once he grew up modern Orthodox, and once time the guy grew up completely Chabad from his birth. His father is a big Chabad rabbi. So I'm with these Chabad Shluchim, and I go through the whole story. I tell the story of a good 5 minutes, how Rav Zevin, during World War I, you know, they had to leave their town, and they were wandering. And the people of Novozibkov heard that this great rabbi was going through, and they went and they grabbed him, and he lived in my grandfather's house, then they appointed him rabbi, and I go through the whole story. And at the end of it, this has happened three times. Each one of the shluchim were under 30, by the way. The shliach says to me, after listening very politely to the whole story, who is Rav Zevin? So, I mean, it's not like he interrupted me in the middle when I was mentioning Rav Zevin. He let me three times go through the whole story. One of these times this happened. There was an older Chabad guy in the house. I went to pick up my kids at this event, this Makabiyah, so that the Frum kids were at the Chabad rabbi's house. And I get there was an older Chabad guy there who I just spoke to for a minute. And then I was speaking to the Shliach, and I said to him, you ask that guy, I forgot his name, I guarantee you he'll know Rav Zevin. So he says to me, you sure? So we go downstairs, and he asks, he says, did you ever hear of Rav Zevin? And of course, the old Chabadnik says, did I hear of him? What are you talking about? How could I not have heard of him? And then later, the older Chabad guy says to me, when I told him that this guy never heard of Rav Zevin, he says, that's the younger generation. They don't know anything anymore. But so I thought that's interesting. One more thing. If you recall last class, we ended basically with the Rayatz telling his followers, stay in the Soviet Union. You have work to do here. And then he says something more. He says that, make this your Eretz Yisrael. If you remember, a number of semesters ago, we dealt with Ritzi Yehuda Cook. And one of the things that got Ritzi Yehuda so upset, and he has an open letter attacking, was when the Lubavitcher Rebbe of Menachem Mendel Schneerson published a piece, or had a from Reagan, and they published it, in which he said that Eretz Yisrael is wherever you make it. In other words, 770 is our Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, in the Chabad ideology, Aliyah, there's no need to go on Aliyah. If you're already living in the land of Israel, you're not supposed to leave. And it is the Holy Land, but there's no notion of Aliyah as an not only, obviously, not as an obligation, but even as something that you should strive for, something beneficial. Because as the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, the Rav Menachem Mendel, you know, this is our Eretz Yisrael. Wherever you make Torah, wherever you create a Torah environment, that's Eretz Yisrael. And as we saw, Rav Yehuda went crazy over this. You know, you're turning Chutz La'aretz, the impure land, into Eretz Yisrael. So you see that the Rayatz's statement that we can turn Russia into our Eretz Yisrael, and that we're not going to leave here to go to the physical Eretz Yisrael, because this could be our spiritual Eretz Yisrael. There's a long history of that sort of talk. Let's pick up then. That's where we ended last class. In 1927, the Rayatz is arrested. Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the Friedrich Rebbe. He's arrested because of his involvement in Jewish things. At first, they wanted to execute him, and that was the... I don't know if it was actually an official... I think it was, actually, but it's not clear. The official decision to execute him, they wanted to execute him. I don't know if they ever were serious about doing that, but they did sentence him to 3 years in exile in some remote place in Russia. And this created a huge outcry. And due to diplomatic interventions, he was freed 29 days after the arrest. Now, this is, I mean, you see this, we're going to see this soon. I'll talk about Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky. There have been other cases with the great rabbis when they're given a sentence and enough people protest, it leads to a lessening of the sentence or their freedom. The Soviets just they decided to expel him from the Soviet Union. He was giving them too much trouble. When all the other rabbis, who are not so important, Rav Shaul Yisraeli's father and others, when they are sentenced to Siberia, no one knows about them. There's no one to protest. Well, as I said, he wasn't actually expelled from the country. He left the country. We'll see Yecheskel Abramsky. It's a bit of a different situation. But he knew he'd be arrested again, and they told him he could leave. And I guess if he refused to leave, they probably would have expelled him. But he left, and he goes to Latvia, where he remains until World War II. And if you want to read about his adventures during World War II, I'm using the adventures and not in a comic book sense, but in a life and death sense, you can read the book by Brian Rigg, former Marine, now historian, who wrote a book on the rescue of Lubavitcher Rebbe from Latvia. How it's amazing that through bribery, through some humanitarian stuff, you had members of the Nazi Party, members of the intelligence service, the military intelligence service, not the SS, who were all involved in this massive effort to bring the Lubavitcher Rebbe out of send him out of the Nazi clutches. We see similar things with the Gerer Rebbe, with the Belzer Rebbe. So it's a wonderful story. Although, if all his facts are correct, Rigg, who's not he's not even Jewish, never mind not Chabad, there, in some aspects the Rebbe doesn't come out looking so good, because apparently the man who worked very hard to bring him to America, Chabad never paid him everything he was due, and they spent a lot of money on bringing over possessions of the Rebbe. If I recall, not just the books we know are very special, but even silverware and dishes and things like that, then maybe you want to wonder if that's really what was necessary during the Holocaust. But the books were necessary, because Chabad needs those books. So that's what makes them a complete unit going back to the first Rebbe. They've had this amazing library, and the Rayatz himself purchased an enormous amount of books. There was a whole court case, as I'm sure you, at least most of you, know about this, between him and Barry Gerari, so the books are very precious. It is only 3 years later, in 1930, that the Rayatz realizes there's no future for Jews in the Soviet Union, and that's when he begins to urge emigration. But by then, it was very difficult. The Soviet Union was not allowing people out the way they used to. Bill says that he was in Warsaw and brought up by a major Wehrmacht officer who was actually working for the Abwehr. You had this man Canaris, who was the head of the military intelligence. It's a whole thing. Now, when you say the book was a PhD thesis, that's not true. Rigg's first book was a PhD thesis. His first book was on the what they call that the. I forgot the German term now, the mixed Jews, Jewish and non-Jewish, if you had blood in you, half Jewish, half non-Jewish, what their situation was in Germany. That was the first book. The Mischling. People, you often hear it stated by people that if you had one Jewish grandparent, that was enough to send you to the gas chambers. In fact, that's a truism. Every Jew knows if you had one Jewish grandparent, that was enough to take you out, send you to the guest chambers. By the way, Bill says the guy who brought him out was a Mischling. That, I think the whole story comes from the earlier book. It is not true, though. If you had one Jewish grandparent, you were what they call a mixed breed, a Mischling. You were not an Aryan. To be an Aryan, you needed three Jewish grandparents. You needed four German grandparents. But if you had one Jewish grandparent, and even two, depending on if you identify with the Jews, so there was an element there which was not racial, you were classified as a Mischling. You were not sent to the camps. His book was about these Mischlings, some of whom fought in the German army. There were people in the SS who wanted to kill them all, but they decided instead they could sterilize them. It would be too difficult. These people were felt German. They were married to German women. And they remained part of Germany. My only correspondence with Rigg happened, I was reading the book on the Mischling, And he's telling a story about one of these people who has Jewish blood, but he's in the German army. And he tells a story, and he says, unfortunately, he was killed at one of the battles. And I wrote to him, and I said, you know, I'm enjoying your book very much, but I didn't like the word unfortunately. I said, I'm Jewish, and at the end of the day, you know, I never like Jews to be killed, but this Mischling, he chose to cast his lots, his fate, with the with Germany, with the Nazis, and he was fighting in the German army. And through his fighting and the German victories, that meant Jewish extermination. So therefore, I said to Rigg that I can't bring myself to say, unfortunately, he was killed, because at the end of the day, it's good he was killed. It's good that they were all killed. And the fact that he had some Jewish blood in him, if he's fighting for the swastika, you know, I'm not going to say unfortunately. And Rigg wrote back that, you know, these were young people and they were confused, etc. Bill says that Hitler gave him Aryan status, one of 15 half-Jews Hitler cleared. But even the ones, Bill, that Hitler himself didn't clear, this was the policy. They were permitted in the army, and some of them had fairly high ranks. So it is not true. Next time you hear someone say that one Jewish grandparent was sent into the gas chambers, you can correct them. It is not true. You needed more than one Jewish grandparent. As I said, if you had two, then it gets into these religious classifications. At the Wannsee Conference, they dealt with this. It's so strange, because Nazism is supposed to be only about racial categorizations. But they determined if you identified as Jewish, let's say you went to synagogue and you had two Jewish grandparents, then you're on the train to Auschwitz. But if you didn't identify as Jewish and you had two Jewish grandparents, then you weren't. So it sort of breaks down in the end there. So that's the book, by the way, Rescued from the Reich, I think it is the title of it. And the first book is by Brian Rigg, is also wonderful. Let's go back to 1927 now. Remember, we spoke about Rav Shemaria Noach Schneerson, the Bavoyska Rebbe. He dies in 1926. In 1927, there is a gathering of rabbis, of leading rabbis, in the Soviet Union. I shouldn't say leading rabbis, gathering of rabbis, and there's a few leading rabbis, as we'll see. This is encouraged, not just encouraged, this whole event is guided by the Rayats, who wants to make sure Judaism continues in the Soviet Union. He's the moving force. These rabbis are trying to keep Judaism alive. Rav Zevin is chosen as the secretary. There were four rabbis who the Rayats worked with. When he was in the Soviet Union, and then when he moved into Latvia. And their job was to spread Judaism. One was Rav Zevin, who as a Chabadnik, even though he wasn't Lubavitch, had obviously a closer connection to the Rayats than the others. The next was Rav Yecheskel Abramsky of Slutsk. We will have classes on Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, because he's a very interesting figure. And look, his story is very similar to so many other rabbis. We have many rabbis who taught Torah. They refused to stop teaching Torah, sort of like Rabbi Akiva. They didn't have to teach Torah. They didn't have to be involved. They could have saved their skin by simply becoming private people. But just like, as we say, as the Gemara says, you know, you can't take a fish and put it on the dry land. Their job was teaching Torah. And the Jewish communists, they used to warn them. And finally, many of them were sent to Siberia. Terrible, terrible things happened to them. Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky was one of them. He was sent away also. But because he was so well known, he was an important personality, the Western Jewish world was raised out of its slumber, you could say, because you can't protest for everyone, and you can't make efforts for everyone. So when maybe this is wrong, maybe everyone knew that other rabbis were being sent, everyone knew that other citizens were, but you can't arouse people to these actions. If you follow the Haredi world today, you've seen plenty of examples of this. You had these three kids who were carrying drugs, these Satmar-type kids, and since they come from a community with a lot of pull, Satmar, Eda Haredit, there was all these protest rallies and everything, and Nebuch, you have this guy, Ostreicher, who he doesn't have that sort of pull. I think he's from the Hasidic world also. He's been in Bolivia for over a year now. It took a year before anyone started paying attention. And it wasn't like great rabbis were leading the call and everything. The family had to push and push and had to get it before Congress. And now maybe some rabbis will come, but there haven't been these days of prayer. They haven't had, the massive rallies or anything. And that's just the way it is. So Rav Yechezkel Abramsky, Rav Chaim Ozer got involved. They got involved with Mayor Hildesheimer in Berlin. And in England, they got involved. Everyone started pressuring the Soviet Union. And, of course, it doesn't look good when all in the Western world, when diplomats are raising questions about this Rabbi Abramsky because their Jewish constituents are urging them to, it's easier just to expel them. You know, at the end of the day, they don't care. They have enough rabbis they can make examples of. We'll see with Rabbi Abramsky also a pattern that... I mean, I mentioned my own family. They didn't remain in the Soviet Union, as I said, and the ones who remained didn't remain because of the Rayats. They were not the Lubavitch. They were more the Babroisker. But I spoke about how the ones who remained, the children became irreligious, and in my family, the four who remained became irreligious. We see this with Rabbi Abramsky. Rabbi Abramsky, he had religious children. One passed away not too long ago, but he had two children quite famous. One was Shimon Abramsky, died a couple of years ago, professor in London. He was a communist, completely irreligious. He was a real communist, so much so that the British expelled him from Palestine. I mean, he had another son of Yechezkel Abramsky, Yaakov David Abramsky, named after, if I say the name Yaakov David, we know it's the Ridzbaz. The Ridzbaz, who himself was the rabbi in Slutsk. It was a Hebrew poet, also completely irreligious. And, I mean, this is a trend we see. And it's not just, you can't just blame it on the communists, obviously. If you look in the land of Israel, all these great rabbis had children who were irreligious. You look in Western Europe, America, it was the era, it was the time. But the fact is, I pointed out that him staying in the Soviet Union, maybe that had something to do, I don't know, staying in Russia as long as he did, that one of his own sons, just like one of my uncle I mentioned, actually became a communist. Now, obviously not a Stalinist or anything like that, but a Trotskyite or a believer in the cause that religion is the opiate of the masses. So that was the second rabbi, Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. The third, his name was Kalmus, Yaakov Kalmus. He was the Rav of Moscow. He, too, eventually is allowed to leave the Soviet Union. He makes his way to Israel. And there's many responsa from Rav Herzog and others to him. I think he might have even been officially on the Chief Rabbinic Council, Melitza Harabinut HaRashit. And the last one, his name was Menachem Mendel Gluskin. Already from the name Menachem Mendel, you could see that he's Chabad. He never leaves. He remains there, and he becomes rabbi in Leningrad. He dies in 1938. In 35, he becomes Rav of Leningrad. So the Rayats is in Riga. And he's still very involved. He's sending money to the rabbis to do their work, and he's sending letters with instructions. But all of these letters were in code. And when he would send these letters, various individuals, so for example, he would send what appeared to be Torah letters, but it was really letters giving instructions. And what was part of the code? Well, first of all, Rav Zevin was Rashi. Why Rav Zevin Rashi? Because Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. So Rav Shlomo Yosef Rashi. Rabbi Abramsky, he's in Tosefta. So for example, in the letter they'd say things like, and in one of the biographies they give examples of how they would put this all in code. You talk about a Talmudic sugya, which everyone knows, and you say, but we have to ask Tosefta, we have to see what Tosefta says about it, that sort of thing. And that's Abramsky, because Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky in 1925 already published the first volume of Tosefta Kipshuta. Sorry, that's Lieberman. No, his Chazon Yechezkel. He was still in the Soviet Union, but he sent the manuscript out and it was published in Vilna. And he was already known as an expert on Tosefta. He would eventually publish many more volumes of that. Rabbi Kalmus, he's Rabbeinu Tam, because his first name is Yaakov. So that's Rabbeinu Tam. And Gluskin, Rabbi Gluskin, Menachem Mendel Gluskin, he's Seder Hadorot. So when they would say, we have to consult with Seder Hadorot, why Seder Hadorot? Because he was from Minsk. that is Gluskin, who becomes rabbi of Leningrad in 35, but before that he was the Rav of Minsk, as I mentioned. And Rabbi Yechiel Halperin, the author of the Seder Ador, he was the Rav of Minsk. So that was the code that they used. Now, Rav Zevin and the Rayatz were very close, as I mentioned, because of this Chabad connection. Now, it's reported, I can't say if this is true, but it's mentioned in all the Chabad literature, that before the Rebbe, that is before Rayatz, took Rav Menachem Mendel as his son-in-law, to see if he was worthy of being his son-in-law, he sent him to Rav Zevin. So Rav Zevin, as they say, could talk in learning with him. I'm very skeptical of this, because if you know the history of the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his wife, at least the history I've read, this was not a shidduch. Shaul Shimon Deutsch, the way he portrays it, as they chose their own spouses. But it's still certainly possible that after they were going to be married, after they were engaged, because they had it wasn't such a short engagement, if I recall correctly, then he sent them to Rav Zevin. In any event, Rav Zevin did have a close relationship with Rav Menachem Mendel, a close relationship from a distance. I don't know how many times they ever met, but there are loads of letters between them. If you look in the Igros, the letters, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you can see them all on HebrewBooks.org. There's many, many letters between the two. When Rav Menachem Mendel was appointed Rebbe, Rav Zevin affirmed his loyalty towards him. This doesn't mean that Rav Zevin became a blind follower. Rav Zevin still kept his Bavroisker roots. You cannot be a Lubavitcher, for example, and be a Zionist. We're going to see about Rav Zevin Zionism. Lubavitch was always opposed to Zionism. Practically, you can support the state, obviously, as Lubavitcher already did, but to see the state of Israel in a Zionistic fashion, the way Rav Zevin was, you can't be a Lubavitcher and view it that way. So Rav Zevin did not adopt the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He wasn't completely, as we say, Mevatel himself. And yet, he identified Menachem Mendel as his Rebbe. Except for in certain areas, he followed a tradition different than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He did, after all, he was older than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He didn't feel like he had to give up his independence completely. But he still looked towards the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He sought his advice. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe sought Rabbi Zevin's advice. If you read the letters, your sense is that these are two equals speaking to one another. Rav Zevin in Eretz Yisrael, leading Chabad figure there, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe in America. You don't get the sense the Lubavitcher Rebbe never pulls rank, and you don't get the sense that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is his Rebbe, but Rav Zevin did think and look towards him as the leader of Chabad, and as his Rebbe, although not in an exclusive sense. Baruch says, you cannot be connected to another Rebbe. A chassid must... You know, Baruch, I think you're speaking 21st century. There were lots and lots of people. You're too young to remember. There was a whole era before World War II of Hasidim, just to give you an example, of Hasidim who were beardless, of people who went to a Rebbe. And even though they went to a Rebbe, and I'm not just talking about like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I'm talking about Rebbes even like the Belzer Rebbe and the Munkacher Rebbe, they still sent their kids to university. They still were even Zionists. You had people who went to Rebbes who were still Zionists. You had fellow travelers. It's hard to imagine today when, for example, the notion of a beardless chassid or the notion of a chassid who, doesn't hold of everything the Rebbe says, it's not the world we live in today. But you had the whole phenomenon. So, for example, before World War II, when we speak about the Ger Rebbe in Poland as having some 200,000 Hasidim, the leading Jewish leader, many of these, perhaps the majority of them, were fellow travelers, that is, people who went to him, but not people who followed every single thing he said. It's a different sense of a Rebbe. It's very much like the Lithuanians used to relate to the Rosh Yeshiva. And therefore, you're saying you mean a Lubavitcher theology, but Rav Zevin's not a Lubavitcher. But even in Lubavitch theology, let me tell you something else. Rabbi Graubert, who was a Rav in Poland, and then later a Rav in Canada, in Toronto, he wrote a wonderful autobiography, and he tells about how all these Lubavitchers were sending their kids to the secular schools. And these are real Lubavitchers, even despite the Rebbe, and the Rebbe knew about it. The idea that even in the old country, all Lubavitchers listened to everything the Rebbe said, we have the evidence that it wasn't the case. If you look in the autobiography of Ben Sion Dinur, he speaks that he has stories there about a Lubavitcher who was not exactly following. Okay, so you're saying current Lubavitcher theology. Obviously, current Lubavitcher theology. The only question, Baruch, about current Lubavitcher theology is whether the Rebbe's Mashiach, whether he's Mashiach or whether he's coming back, or this is that for many of them. I mean, in his lifetime, I think it was obvious. He was, not only was he Mashiach, he was the infallible figure. So, yeah. But Rav Zevin wasn't like that. Okay, he's kashrus. Okay, very good. Thank you. Let's go on. Rav Zevin, by the way, was very close to Rabbi Abramsky. They put out a Torah journal. There was a Torah journal published in the Soviet Union. It's called Yad Yotorah. I looked on HebrewBooks.org. Unfortunately, they only have one of the issues on there. Two issues were put out. These both were reprinted in Jerusalem in the late 70s, but Hebrew Books only has one of them. This journal, if I recall correctly, in, let's see, it's the second issue, the first issue? I think it's the second issue. There's an article in there by Ramosha Feinstein in that journal Yagdil Torah. This journal, Yagdil Torah, had appeared earlier in the century. There was a journal, Yagdil Torah, edited by two great Gedolim. Well, one great Gedolim, one, I guess, second level Rav. The first Gedol's name was Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer. And if you look in the letters of Rav Kook, there's a letter from Rav Kook to Rav Zalman telling him, you know, obviously Rav Zalman had asked him advice or how to run this Torah journal, and you have a letter there from Rav Kook, because Rav Kook also put out a Torah journal. It only had, I think, one issue, though. The other rabbi is Rav Moshe Tomashov, Moshe Binyamin Tomashov, who's known as the Mabit. They left Russia. Well, the Rav Zalman goes to the land of Israel, and Rav Tomashov comes to America. And he restarts the journal. And this journal, Yagdil Torah, went on for a number of years, published out of Brooklyn. And you can see on HebrewBooks.org issues. These journals are great, because if you want to know what the Torah world was like in America in the 1910s, 1920s, this is before Hapardes. Once Hapardes comes on the scene in the late 20s, then you have a monthly, you have everything. But you can look in this journal, which doesn't just have Torah articles, it has, you see some of the controversies there, it has news, advertisements even, if I recall, that has, Hapardes has great advertisements. So, who's the Mabit? Who's the Mabit's grandson? Anyone know the Mabit's grandson? The Mabit's grandson, Moshe Binyamin Tomashov, is Gerald Yaakov Blitzstein, professor, I think emeritus now, of Jewish philosophy at Bar-Ilan University, actually of Jewish thought at Bar-Ilan University, winner of the Pras Yisrael, Israel's greatest award. According to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Gerald Blitzstein, who's extremely prolific, I don't know how he puts out so much in Hebrew and English, is the greatest student that Rav Soloveitchik ever had. So maybe you can argue with that and say Rav Lichtenstein's the greatest student that Rav Soloveitchik ever had, but at least from what Rav Lichtenstein says, that Gerald Blitzstein, who could have been a Rosh Yeshiva, could have been anything, the greatest student. And it's worth noting that because the Rav in the 1950s never had a good relationship with the overwhelming majority of the students. He was aloof. They were afraid of him. If you speak to people from the 50s, they will tell you that the Rav had always had a very close relationship with Blitzstein because of his grandfather. They had a connection through the grandfather. So that Blitzstein could speak to the Rav and shoot the breeze with him in a way that you couldn't do that in the 1950s if you were just a regular guy. You had to wait maybe to the 70s before the Rav calmed down a bit. Blitzstein always had a very close relationship. And Blitzstein is the one who famously asked the Rav when he had the whole issue in the 60s about saving non-Jews on Shabbos. And the Rav goes, he doesn't understand what all the disputes are about. We always save non-Jews on Shabbos. If we don't save them, they won't save us. Blitzstein asks him, and this is in front of people, does that satisfy you ethically or morally? And Rav Soloveitchik replies, no, it does not satisfy me ethically. I've repeated this story numerous times. I quoted it in an article or in my book. But it is actually Blitzstein who gets the credit for asking this question. Okay, before we go on, let's see what we've said here. I didn't say Ben-Gurion. I said Bar-Ilan. If I said Bar-Ilan, it's a mistake. It's Ben-Gurion. I was fortunate last year. We actually had a conference there. The conference on the only... Mark Shapiro is only on YouTube one time. They take that and they put my talk at Ben-Gurion University. That's the conference run by Ben-Gurion, Danny Lasker, and Howard Chaim Kreisel, and Jerry Blitzstein. So it was a wonderful gathering, and then they put all the lectures on YouTube. So yes, he's definitely in Ben-Gurion, and Ben-Gurion, Be'er Sheva, from when Be'er Sheva was nothing. When it was an outpost, you go there now and look how big it is. So that's Jerry Blitzstein. He's been there since, oh, it's got to be at least the early 70s. Baruch says that a chassid of one rebbe cannot give a kvittel to another rebbe. Yeah, okay, you're right, but Rav Zevin wasn't giving any kvittelach. You're right, obviously, if you have one. Incidentally, before we go on, I've spoken in the past about how it is dual loyalty. I've spoken in the past about how the Lithuanian world is becoming very Hasidic, and I spoke about this, what I call the papal model in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, that there is one authority, one leader, like a pope, who all decisions go to him. Just today, or yesterday, was published a letter from Rav Chaim Kanievsky. I am unaware of anything like this. This is a new development, as far as I know, in the Haredi world, in which, according to this letter, obviously Rav Eliashiv is very ill, and he's not going to be involving himself anymore in, he could be literally on his deathbed now. They're saying it's critical. Rav Chaim Kanievsky puts out a letter saying that Hanhagat Hador, that is the direction, the rulership of the community, of the generation, really, has now been passed to Rabbi Steinman. And everyone has to follow Rabbi Steinman. I mean, so it's not just the papal model, it's that now it's declaring that this is the new one, that it used to be unofficial, that the great leader sort of developed, but now there's been an official declaration that Rabbi Steinman is the new leader. And then the statement goes on to say everyone is obligated to listen to him. I'm not sure if that's just a rhetorical flourish. It's just a way of saying that he's our leader now, or if he actually means that you have to listen to everything Rabbi Steinman says. I don't know, but you see here this is very Hasidic, where the Hasidim crown a Rebbe, and everyone must follow him. Now it's that the next Lithuanian Rebbe, the next Lithuanian final authority, has already been crowned, and I don't know of any other examples where there's a declaration like this, that the baton has been passed. And then it goes on to say that he's now in charge of Yated Ne'aman, just like the Vatican has their official newspaper. Yated Ne'aman is the mouthpiece for Das Torah, so this is very important. And Posek Hador, it's funny, because who's Posek Hador? The Lithuanians, Rav Eliashiv is the Posek Hador. The others say that, or maybe you can have two Posek Hadors, I don't know, but I don't know when they started calling him Posek Hador. If you're looking at Tate Ne'aman, one person would get Maran, and that would be Rav Eliashiv. And now they've cleaned house, they put in a whole new editorial board, so now you have also Rabbi Steinman. But I just think it's very interesting, because you didn't have this in the Haredi world years ago. Even a figure like Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski, you still had others who disagreed with him. They debated him halachically and hashkafically. You had people, and they were never thought to be mechutz l'machana. And I'm talking about agudists who had differences of opinion. We already saw differences of opinion about crown rabbis and things like this. This notion that we're going to crown a Haredi leader and no one can disagree with him, that's very Hasidic. In the Hasidic world, the Rebbe is the boss. You don't disagree with the Rebbe. If you want to, then go find another group. Let's go on. So the Yagyo Torah, this was the only Torah journal ever published in the Soviet Union, as far as I know. Rav Zevin realizes, though, that there's no future in the Soviet Union. And already by 1930, he's ready to go. In 1931, he had been in touch with Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski, and Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski writes to Rav Cook. Yes, Baruch. Yeah, we know he's Hasidic. We had classes on the Steiper all about the Hasidus. You can look in the letters to Rav Cook. There's a letter, Igrot, letters to Rav Cook, and you see there a letter from Chaim Moser in 1931 asking him if he could arrange a visa or an entrance visa for Rabbi Zevin, the Rav of Novozibkov. So here, Rav Zevin is leaving Novozibkov. My family was still in Novozibkov. Is that right? Once he leaves, there's never again a rabbi in Novozibkov. So all my family that's still in Novozibkov, once Rav Zevin leaves, there's no Rav, there's no Shlita. But of course Rav Zevin should have left. What's he going to do? Well, there's no future for his children there. He doesn't have to sacrifice everything. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. Rav Zevin was obviously luckier than people like my family and others because they couldn't get out. Rav Zevin's a great rabbi and he had connections. But if, you know, other people had other sort of connections, they could get out as well. So Rav Zevin is able to get an entrance visa. It took a while, 4 years. Because it isn't just, I don't know how long it took Rav Kook to get the visa, to get the entrance papers to get into Palestine, but the Soviet Union, it still was difficult to get out. If you can read Rabbi Abramsky. Rabbi Abramsky had permission to leave, and to leave the Soviet Union, and this went on for well over a year. Even though he had permission, the Soviets wouldn't give him an exit visa. And then he was sent into exile. So he was given the position, officially, of Rav Petach Tikva. And they held it for him for a complete year. And when, after a year of waiting and letters, he wasn't getting out, they asked the Shiloh, and they were told that they can't hold it for him forever, and they can give it to someone else, and they gave it to Rabbi Reuven Katz. Reuven Katz, who had been in America, in Bayonne, New Jersey, becomes the Rav Petach Tikva. And apparently they say there was tension always between Rav Abramsky and Petach Tikva. I don't know about Rav Zevin, but because Rav Abramsky obviously wanted them to hold on to the position as long as they could. And there's an article that came out recently about this whole issue of they published the letters back and forth from Petach Tikva to Rav Zevin, to Rav Abramsky, and they kept saying, you know, we can't hold it anymore, we can't hold it. He desperately wanted to come to Eretz Yisrael. He was a great lover of Zion. But, and he did. Before I go further, I'm going to hold on to these questions and comments. I don't want to ruin the flow. So in 20 minutes, I'll come back to the questions. We'll go through them all. It's not till 1935 that Rav Zevin was finally given permission to leave, and he's able to meet Rav Kook. Rav Kook dies in Elul, the third of Elul, so Rav Zevin's able to come and meet him. He's 47 years old. So everything we're going to speak about now, all of Rav Zevin's achievements, his accomplishments, his writings, they all happen from 1935 on, from age 47 and on. I'm not 47 yet, and it's amazing to think that Rav Zevin, what he was able to accomplish, just beginning from the year, when he's 47 years old. Can you imagine if he was in the land of Israel or in America from his 20s, when he had to worry about the Soviet Union and all those problems, what he would have been able to accomplish? It's mind-boggling. What does he do when he comes to the land of Israel? As is fitting, his first position is teaching for the Mizrahi, at the Mizrahi Teachers Institute. He had no problems with the Mizrahi, and we'll see his attitude. Later, he's appointed editor of the Talmudic Encyclopedia, and that's how he earned his living for the rest of his life. He was employed by the Talmudic Encyclopedia. That's what he wanted to do. We're going to talk about this encyclopedia in a minute. He was also the rabbi of Shazar, President Shazar, who, when I say the rabbi in quotes, President Shazar comes from a Chabad background. I'm not sure. I didn't look it up. I don't know if that's he's Babroisk or Lubavitch, but when Shazar used to come to an America, he would go visit the Lubavitch Rebbe. He's a laborite, and he was very far from religion most of his life. Towards the end of his life, when he became president, I think even before that, he comes back to religion, he used to go to Kfar Chabad. He would come to America, and the labor politicians would be like, well, you're going to see this rabbi in Brooklyn? You're the president of Israel. The rabbi should come see you. I mean, what is this, that our president is going? But Shazar's attitude was that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a chassid, and he's my rebbe. So the president of the state of Israel is going, he would always go visit the Lubavitch rebbe. And then Begin did it too. And Begin wasn't the Lubavitcher by any means. He's from Brisk, but he went to Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rabbi Zevin was the rabbi, in quotes, of Shazar. And from 1964, he's a member of the Moetzet Rabbanut HaRashit, the chief rabbinical council of the State of Israel, which is, of course, the Zionist rabbinic entity. This was before there were any Haredim in the Chief Rabbinate. In the 1960s, Haredim would have nothing to do. You would never have Haredi Dayanim. You would never have Haredim in the Chief Rabbinate. The whole thing was puzzle. It was forbidden. This all changes, as I mentioned before, when Rav Yoshev, when he becomes the new leader, he changes this, and he doesn't want to fight the Chief Rabbinate and oppose it. He believes in conquering it. And all these religious Zionists who were so happy when Rav Yoshev started having his people, you know, take the test for the Dayanim, that this is going to lead to some sort of rapprochement, and the Haredim are going to be together with the religious Zionists. Now there's a lot of nostalgia for the days when the Haredim wanted nothing to do with the Chief Rabbinate, because what did they do? They came over and they took over all the Batei Din. They took over various chief rabbinical positions in cities, and it was a lot better in the 50s and 60s when the Haredim wanted nothing to do. We wouldn't have the conversion controversies, we wouldn't have any of these machlokes we've had if Rav Yoshev had never been appointed, become the head Haredi leader. And I'll take it back one more step. I mentioned before, had Rav Goren never become chief rabbi, which the religious Zionists were so excited about, had they voted for Rabbi Unterman, like the Lubavitcher Rebbe told them to, or Tzvi Yehuda Kook told them to, because you don't kick out a Rav. Just because a Rav is old, you don't kick him out. Rav Yoshev never would have left the chief rabbinate. And if he never left the chief rabbinate, he would have lived out his life as a Dayan, and that would have been that. So we never would have had this Haredi takeover of the Chief Rabbinate. But Rabbi Zevin becomes a member of the Chief Rabbinic Council. And he has a reputation already early on, in the early days in Palestine, of being an original writer. In fact, he wasn't just original, he was unique. He created a new style of writing. He is the first one to write the sorts of articles he did. Open up Hamodim B'Halacha. Open up La'or Halacha, Ishim V'Shitot. No one wrote those sorts of articles. And I'm speaking both from a technical standpoint and also substantively. When I say technically, articles, now we take it for granted. But who wrote articles with footnotes? He follows this model of like a secular writer, with you have a text and then you have footnotes. Now you have these Sfarim. You have one line of text, if one line, you have a whole page of notes. And I'm not even just talking about independent works. Take a look at the Ritva. Take a look at the Ritva, Basar Rav Kook published on Yevamos. You get one, two lines, and then you get this, the editors, all of this stuff. This is not a traditional form of writing. Text with footnotes. But Rav Zevin thought it worked, so he used it. It takes off. To write about different themes in the holidays, the way he did, to write about the shitot, the viewpoints, not the political viewpoints, but the viewpoints in Torah from their Sfarim of these great rabbis, no one had ever written about these things like this before. To write about halachic matters, different themes, war, snow, I'll talk about his article on snow soon, Shylock and Halacha, these are the sorts of things that today we take for granted. No one had done them. When Rav Zevin wrote about these articles, no one had written Torah articles about these sorts of topics. You have a Torah article, you write, you analyze a sugya and shas, you write a question on halacha, but to raise a question, was Shylock's, the idea of Shylock take a pound of flesh, is that halachically permissible? I mean, all the halachic essays, Rav Zevin is the first one to write halachic essays. I'm not talking about responsa here. I'm talking about halachic essays. As I said, now we take it for granted. Now you have many people. When I was in Israel, my yeshiva, one of my rabbeim, was Rabbi Mirsky. I mean, he's published Mosadar of Kook, a number of volumes. You have many, many people writing halachic essays. We have it in English. We have it in Hebrew, too. Wonderful writers, wonderful books. So, La'or Halacha, Modim Halacha, we have. We still don't have Ishim V'Shitot. No one has been able to duplicate that. I'm going to speak about all these books in a few minutes. How about his more popular volumes? Hasidic Teachings on the Holocaust. By the way, Hamodi B'Halacha has been translated to English. It's great. You can buy it at Art Scroll. Why Ishim V'Shitot has not been translated to English, which I think is his most incredible work, and La'or Halacha, why they haven't, I can't tell you. Art Scroll did translate to his Hasidic Teachings on the Torah, which is, if you're looking for a Dvar Torah, it's great. This is the sort of work that when you're resting on a Shabbos afternoon, you take it out, you read it. But Rav Zevin was a chassid. So I mentioned that his grandson in the introduction says that Tzurkin Gedolin encouraged him not to write this book. They said, don't do this. It's not worthy of respect for you to be writing Maiselach, Hasidic stuff. I don't think a Hasidic Rav would have said that, but maybe a Hasidic Rav would have, I don't know. But from Rav Zevin was always a man of the people. He wasn't just an intellectual. So he wrote these books. In the introduction, I'll get to all the questions in the middle. Yeah, Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. Hasidic Tales is from the Torah, yeah. Well, the tales he has there are put forth teachings. I'm confusing it with, also with, what's her name? Yaffa Eliach's book. In the introduction to Or HaHalacha, his grandson, or maybe it's more than one grandson writing it, but I think it's Rabbi Nachum Zevin from Haifa. He says as follows, and even though his grandson said it, it's still true. His grandson says, it is difficult to find anyone in our generation. And when he says our generation, he's older. He means the generation, the 70s, 80s. Even up to today, you could say. It's difficult to find anyone in our generation. He says it's difficult. I'll say it's impossible. To find anyone in our generation who was as learned as Rav Zevin in Halacha and Agadah, Kabbalah, Chassidut, Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaalpeh, responds of Rishonim and Achronim. I believe that statement has to stand. There is no person, take from the Holocaust up until today, post-World War II, who was as wide-ranging, as versatile, as learned in all those areas, not to know it cocktail knowledge, surface knowledge, detailed knowledge. The only one who I would put in that category and put perhaps as an equal to Rav Zevin would be Rav Menachem Kasher, who also, I don't know what he knew about Kabbalah, but, I mean, other than Kasher, I can't think of anyone other than Rav Zevin who has such a broad range. And we don't know about his halacha so much because they haven't yet published his response. I mean, incredible. But he was also, he wasn't just an intellectual. He was known as a wonderful conversationalist. And there's many, many stories. Lieberman tells, this is a good story from Lieberman. He was very friendly with Lieberman. I found in the Lieberman archive, there's letters from Rav Zevin. But everyone knows, Rav Zevin and Lieberman were very close. But Lieberman said that he would always go visit Rav Zevin. Why? Because when he'd go visit him, when he's done, I don't know, he stays there a half hour, an hour, whatever it is, Lieberman can get up and leave. But he said that if he didn't go visit Rav Zevin, Rav Zevin would come visit him, and Rav Zevin is a Hasidic guy, and Hasidim, they like to talk. And it's impolite. You can't, Lieberman couldn't say to Rav Zevin, you know, you've been here an hour, you've been here an hour and a half, I have to get back to my work, I have to get back to Tosefta Kipshuta, or whatever I'm working on. So therefore, he said he always wanted to visit Rav Zevin, because if Rav Zevin came over, Rav Zevin loved to talk, and you couldn't get rid of him, and therefore it's best to go there. And if, obviously, if Lieberman was there and Rav Zevin wants to talk more, Lieberman could say, oh, I have to leave. And we know that Rabbi Zevin had wonderful midot. I'll just give you one example of this to show you. When I say he's a man of the people, and I even got a little sense of that from my grandfather's brother or great uncle, that you have certain rabbis who can't relate to the common man. And then you have others, and Rav Zevin was always one to relate to the common man. He would go to, he would speak a lot, obviously, Rav Zevin. So they'd have at Mosad Rav Kook and other places, they'd have events where, you know, Rav Zevin would be the prime speaker. When you're in Jerusalem, you always see these signs, Yom Shekulo Torah, things like that. And you have in big letters, you have at the top the big rabbi, Ravad Yosef, or Shlomo Amar, or whoever the big name is. And then you'll have underneath the smaller letters. And I've been to a few of these events. And what it is that it's not always that the big name speaks first. But if the big name speaks first, then he's done his talk, he leaves. And then the people remain, most of them, to hear the other talk. Sometimes the big name, maybe he's supposed to speak first, but he doesn't get there in time. He comes in the middle. It's a little embarrassing, unfortunately. The other guy is giving his talk, and the big name comes in. Everyone starts singing and things, and it's a bit of, I think, a disgrace for the person who's speaking. But okay, the rabbi comes in, and the man finishes, and then the big rabbi speaks. And then they leave. That's what they do. Rabbi Zevin, when he used to have events like this, be at events, he would give his talk, and then he would sit down and remain to the end, even if it's another 2 hours, listening to the talks of the others. And some of these rabbis would be embarrassed. You know, I'm supposed to speak in front of Rav Zevin? That's what he would do. I mentioned before the article about snow. If you open up Or HaHalacha, here I have it. Let me read you some of the articles. He has a whole long section on war. Then he has on the Hebrew state, he has a whole thing on Shemitah. Hakel, all about Hakel. Women in Mitzvah Saseh, the Akedah in Halacha, Sheleg, snow in Halacha, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the Kuzari in Halacha, the number 13 in Halacha and Agadah, Shira Shirim, etc., etc., lots of stuff. And of course, Shylock, Hillel and Shammai. I'll talk about the Hillel and Shammai article later. He has this article on snow, though. What's an article on snow? And there's a story. He would constantly be giving shiurim every week. He'd give more than once a week, but he had a regular shiur once a week that lots of people would come to. And once it started snowing, let's say the shiur is supposed to start, I don't know, let's say 8 o'clock, and it's already 8 o'clock, but everyone's outside watching the snow. Snow in Jerusalem is not so common, and apparently it was a very beautiful snow. They asked Rav Zevin there tonight, could he speak as a shiur, speak about halachic aspects of snow? Let me just give you some of the headings here. It's not such a short article. It's a 8-page or 7-page article. He speaks about tuma and about snow. What about snow? It's not. Is it a food or is it a drink? You know, mikvah. There's mikvah issues. If you can use, ice, snow, things like that. Let's say you make. He's talking about Torah, a shelig, but Torah davar she'eino mitkayim. Can it be an ohel, like make an igloo or something? Breaking snow. What are the halachic aspects on Shabbos? Can you break it? All these aspects. Even the ends of the last paragraph is cold. There's issues if it's freezing, different halachic aspects. What's this? The Esther of Zevin, it's snowing outside. Give us a shear on snow. So he gives them a shear off the top of his head. Look, I could think of the topics. I can't give a shear off the top of my head, but if you're asking me off the top of my head, I could think of the same topics. Can you walk in the snow on Shabbos? Cold, it's cold on Shabbos. Other aspects, can I make a snowball? All sorts of things. I don't know. I can think of the questions. I don't know the answers, though, that I need to prepare. But Rav Zevin was enough of a sage that it's all in his head. So he gives the shear, and then he sends it off. Every week he'd, send off. He had an article that appeared in HaTzofeh for some, 35 years. Every week he'd have an article in HaTzofeh. He didn't write for Hamodia. He wrote for HaTzofeh, which is a religious Zionist paper. He sent off the article on Shelet to HaTzofeh, and it appeared the next week, and that's how it started. And it was reprinted in Or HaHalacha. There are hundreds of articles of his in HaTzofeh and other places, Torah journals as well, but in HaTzofeh, which had not yet been collected. Many of them were. He used to do book reviews. Who else did book reviews? They do book reviews. If you look in the Jewish Observer, they used to do book reviews. Or if you look in some of these Torah journals, but they're not book reviews. What they are is, if they don't like the book, they'll attack it. And if any book they review which they like, all it is praise. You'll never have them. They only attack someone if they think he's a heretic or a modern Orthodox type. But they'll never take someone who's, let's say, in their world, an agudist, and actually do a critical review. They just don't do that. It's all fluff. Rav Zevin wrote real reviews. Almost every week he'd have a piece, or every other week, and not so fast. Many of these were collected in 3 big volumes of Sofrim Usfarim, of his collected articles. But he wrote so many other things. He wrote articles about political issues, about Inyana de Yoma, etc. These still need to be collected. When he did reviews, these were real reviews. These were reviews where he read the books. He talked about the significant aspects of the teachings. He gave criticisms. Haredi newspapers are incapable of doing this. Not because the people are incapable, but because they don't understand the idea of criticism. Like, how can you write a review of a Torah sage and offer criticism? They'll do it in Shuvot. Everyone does it. You'll say a position is difficult. But they don't know this idea of reviews. It's not a traditional Jewish thing to write book reviews. But just like the footnotes were not traditional Jewish, and just like we'll see the encyclopedia is not the traditional Jewish thing, and don't tell me about the Pachad Yitzchak and the Stechemet, I'll talk about that in a minute, so too the book reviews. After Rav Herzog dies, 1959, many people asked Rabbi Zevin to stand as chief rabbi. I mean, he had all the credentials, great Torah scholar, well-known, religious Zionist. He chose not to. He was also told there wouldn't be any opposition to him, which meant that Rabbi Unterman, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, had to go along with this. According to his grandson, the reason in the introduction to Or HaHacha, or in the introduction to Yeshiva Shitot, the reason he turned down the chance to be chief rabbi is because he wanted to work on the Talmidic Encyclopedia. He saw that as his life's dream and his greatest achievement. And if he became chief rabbi, he wouldn't have any opportunities for that. So he wouldn't be the first person who turned down an opportunity for fame and, you know, the respect and all that because he had important writings he needed to do. Before I get to the Talmudic Encyclopedia and its significance, how it came about, let me read you, since I mentioned about, you know, him being chosen as chief rabbi, what his grandson says about him and the state of Israel. Because there's no attempt in the introduction to deny that he's a Zionist. His grandson says it explicitly. Heyotu Tzioni, he was a Zionist. But what does that mean to be a Zionist? That's where his grandson feels the need to... and I need to find out. I'm going to David Eisen, I asked him to look into this, because he told me something very interesting. He's been in touch with the family, and he sent me an email today, which I have to get to next class, next semester, about the supposed letter Rav Zevin wrote about the need for people to serve in the army. We have new information on that, which David uncovered. But I want him to find out about this Rabbi Nachum Zevin. I think he's a Chabadnik, but not a complete Chabadnik. In any event, he doesn't try to cover anything up. He says... this is on page 31, Hashkafato Shel Saba Ahamadina Haita Brura. My grandfather had a clear view of what the state of Israel meant and its purpose. And he used to say that there are different views on the Medina. Some say it's the beginning of the redemption of Hakadulua, and others say it's not even the beginning. What did my grandfather say? He says, I'm not among the people who say it's the beginning of the redemption, and I'm not among the people, that is the Haredim, who say we don't even have any redemption here, any beginning. It's nothing. He says, Me'olam lo hayiti b'shamayim. He says, I was never in heaven. Ve'eneni yodea im zo atchalta v'ula. And I do not know if this is the beginning of the redemption. Oh, no, we're not the beginning of the redemption. Masha barurli, what's clear to me, Hamadina Tshua Gedola Higa Am Yisrael, that the state is a great savior, great salvation for the people of Israel, and in the creation of the Medina, there are many miracles. Who does this sound like? In fact, he even uses the same words, that the state of Israel is Yeshua. It's redemption. It's valuable. It's not the beginning of the redemption or anything like that, but it's not Yeshua, not in redemption, but salvation. It saves Jews. There you go, Bill. I was about to say, Bill, you definitely know it. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is old-time religious Zionism. This is Rabbi Reines, old-time Mizrahi. That we don't talk about Atalta the Gula. We're not in Messianic times. We have to be a realpolitik. If we want to know if we give back land, from Tzeuda Cook's perspective, we're in the beginning of redemption. We're even more than the beginning. We need to have faith. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik, none of this. Halacha doesn't know about Atchalta Gula or anything like that. You need to know whether you give back land, whether you should. Just like on Yom Kippur, you ask a doctor if you have to fast, so too you ask the experts. And the Rav said this about Soviet Jewry parades and rallies and all these sorts of things, that you ask the experts. But that's Rabbi Soloveitchik's non-Messianic Zionism. What you have here by Rabbi Zevin is a non-Messianic Zionism. The state of Israel is wonderful, it's great, it's valuable, and it's going to accomplish great things, and we will reach a redemption eventually, but the state as we have it today should not be seen as we are not in the Messianic era. He goes on. Let me just one more minute. On Yom Ha'atzmaut, he would say Hallel without a bracha, his grandson tells us, because that's what the Rabbanu Tarashit, the chief rabbinate, that was their decree. Until Rabbi Goren became chief rabbi, they never said it with a bracha. Then he goes on that when one day someone said to Rav Zevin used to go to Mosad Harav Kook. There's a shul. Maybe some of you have been there. There's a shul at Mosad Harav Kook. And at Mosad Harav Kook shul, the Rav there, or the leader, was Rabbi Maimon, Yehudalei Maimon, the big Mizrahi leader. They said Hallel with the bracha. There's even a picture. I couldn't find it, though. I thought I had it. I couldn't find it. A Rav Zevin sitting next to Rabbi Maimon, Fishman Maimon, together on Yom Ha'atzmaut davening. So they used to say Hallel there with the bracha. And Rav Zevin used to go there. So someone asked him, why do you go there to say Hallel with a bracha? Because your position is you don't say Hallel with a bracha. And Rabbi Zevin replied, I go there despite the fact that they say it with a bracha. So why does he go there? He says, Bebatei HaKnesset Shebemakom, you know, in the shuls in my area. I think he lived in Geula. In fact, I'm sure he lived in Geula. They don't say Hallel at all. Therefore, I prefer to daven in a place where they say Hallel, and even with a bracha, than to daven in a place where they don't say it at all. That's the story. It is a bit of a strange story, because there's plenty of shuls in Jerusalem where he could have gone, and they would have said it without a bracha, but they would have said Hallel. Why did he have to go dafka to Mosad Rav Kook, and to daven with, and where they say with a bracha? I think his answer was a bit of a smart aleck answer, a cute answer. The real reason he went there is because he was very, very close to Rabbi Maimon. He spoke at all the Torah Sheba'al Peh gatherings. He published stuff with Mosad Rav Kook, and he thought that was the place to be on Yom Ha'atzmaut. And if they say it with a bracha, fine, he won't say it with a bracha. That, I think, is the real reason. He had a lifelong friendship with Rabbi Maimon. There is a lot we need to say more about him in the State of Israel. And in fact, what Bill says, he was like the Rav. I'm going to read you something where it is identical to what Rabbi Soloveitchik, where Soloveitchik's position is. And then we'll get into his view of the army and the encyclopedia and other things. Let me now, before we say goodnight for this semester, let me go back and see some of the questions and the comments here. Baruch says, when Rav Menashe Klein passed away, some of his backers, probably some family members, tried to label him Posek Hador. Yeah, it is laughable because at the end of the day, Posek Hador means you have to have a constituency. You could be the most brilliant person in the world. Rav Menashe Klein was brilliant. He knew an enormous amount, but he had no constituency. So how can you be Posek Hador? Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski was the Posek Hador of his generation. I tell you right now that the Rugachever knew more than Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski. The Rugachever was a greater Talmud Chacham than Rav Chaim Ozer. I don't think anyone would dispute that. But as Rabbi Weinberg says in his famous responsum against the Rugachever, there's a reason why we don't follow halacha like the Rugachever. He could be the Gaon Hador, the greatest genius of the generation, but he's not the Posek Hador. He's not the and so you're right. That's it is laughable. And Rabbi Yoshev obviously has a great following. I will get to Yiddo, the Encyclopedia Talmudit. We'll have to talk a lot about the encyclopedia. The name itself we'll talk about. Well, that's not a Jewish name, encyclopedia. Here again, we see Rav Zevin's impact. See, Dov is typing something. I'll wait for this. I think when I see you typing, I don't know if you're connected. If you type something else, if it shows up as typing, so I don't know. I'll wait another minute. Next semester, we're going to deal with his letter, supposed letter, attacking the Haredi mentality that you don't need to go to the army because you're a yeshiva student. There's a whole story to that as well. And also the art scroll, what they did to Modim Hacha. Dov says, not sure you can say Haredi would never have entered the rabbinate without Goren becoming chief rabbi. It might not have happened the same way. Okay, you're right, you never know the future. What I can tell you is that by Rav Goren becoming chief rabbi, Rav Yoshev couldn't work with him. Rav Yoshev then resigns. Once he resigns, he was always giving shear, but in Meisharim, but now he can become kosher because he's not attached to the Pussel Chief Rabbinic. People start coming to his classes, and throughout the 1970s into the 1980s, he then becomes this important figure in the Haredi world, and he's a posek, which the other Haredi leaders were not. Rav Shach and the Stipe were. Rav Yoshev never could have come in without that. And how could it have changed? A court before Rav Yoshev became the head man, Yated Ne'eman and followed Rav Shach's position that the Dayanim, it was forbidden to be a Dayan for the Israeli government. The only way this Das Torah can be changed is if you get someone just as big as Rav Shach. How are you going to get someone just as big as Rav Shach? Rav Yoshev came from the chief rabbinate world. He came from that world, so therefore he didn't view it as puzzle. He viewed it as something we could take over. If it was a typical Haredi or Rabbi Steinman or others who came from that world, where would they get the idea that we can move into the chief rabbinate? So Yated Ne'eman, almost overnight, when Rav Yoshev gave the new Das Torah, now all of a sudden Yated Ne'eman is fighting about how we have to make sure that there are Dayanim who are Haredim and who follow Das Torah before Rav Yoshev came in. All they wrote about how it was puzzle, these Dayanim, because the Chazon Ish and the Stipe and all of them said you can't be a Dayan for the chief rabbinate. The Stipe definitely said it. It's in his letters. They say the Chazon Ish said it as well. I don't know if he did. So you're right. Things could have turned out differently, but I think we have to give credit to Rabbi Yoel Yoshev. And at the time, everyone was hopeful. Everyone thought this was a great opportunity to bring the Haredi world into the Rhodes Zionist institutions, and it would moderate them a bit. And it turned out just the opposite. It turned out to be the religious Zionist community's biggest nightmare, so much so that it got to the point where they felt they had to create an alternative rabbinate for conversions and things like that. But you're right. Maybe one day it would have happened. Thank you, Bill. We'll hold off the next semester. Pressure of the need for jobs works wonders, yes. Where is this picture from? This picture is from, I don't know, I found it on the internet. You see that's Rav Herzog behind him. This is Rav Zevin speaking at one of the chief rabbinate gatherings. I don't know if it's the chief rabbinate council or just they used to have all sorts of meetings at Heichal Shlomo. He was part and parcel of that institution. Thank you very much, everyone. Let me just thank you, everyone, again. As always, it's been a good semester. I learned an enormous amount from all the questions and all the comments. Baruch and the rest of you, you keep me on my toes. Do I have new blog posts? I do have a new blog post. I have a blog post that will be coming out very soon, and I really am very interested to see how the Haredi world is going to react to it. Because the truth of the matter is that plenty of Haredim read my writings, and someone just told me today, I did not know about that. There's a whole Yiddish Hyde Park devoted to me with all these Satmar and Hungarian Hasidim types writing in Yiddish. So it shouldn't be said that I don't have connections and friends and everything in the Haredi world. It's not true at all. And every time I do these posts, lots of the emails I get are from Haredim and the commenters. However, I was asked, as one of the things I said I'd be dealing about months and months ago during the Beit Shemesh thing, to talk about Haredim and democracy. Can Haredim ever accept a democratic society in the State of Israel? Or does their ideology, if they ever achieve a majority, mean they have to have a theocracy, just like Iran? And I'm going to write about that. And I happen to think that Haredi society cannot exist democratically, that as a minority, Haredi society works very well, but as a majority culture, they need to create these systems where you'll see what I write, that they will become a religious sort of dictatorship. That's going to be my argument. So I'm curious to see whether Haredim are going to be offended or upset or this and that. And I distinguish, I think it's very different between Israelis and Americans. I quote texts in which Israeli Haredi mock and talk about how terrible democracy is, and we want Torah rule. I think American Haredim recognize that democracy is how valuable it is, because it's the only thing that keeps us have religious freedom. And I would think religious Zionists would recognize the value of democracy because, if you don't have democracy, then each one of our Judaisms stands, there's a chance that someone's going to take it away from us. I mean, if you have a Haredi majority, does that mean that modern Orthodox schools are not funded? Definitely the secular schools won't get funding. So do modern Orthodox schools lose out their funding? I mean, so I happen to think that the Haredi mentality is not capable of living in a democratic system as the Israeli Haredi. So that, Baruch, to give you an insight, that will be the next post that will come out very soon. Truth of the matter is, it could be out already. I'm not sure with Rav Yoshev. You know, he's very, very ill, and I don't want to have a post come out that deals with the Haredi world. And it's not so much critical. It's just saying what I think. I think from their standpoint, I'm quoting them. I think they agree with this, but, you know, if the world's going to be in mourning for the passing of this great Torah sage, I don't want to have a piece that basically talks about how the society is turning into a society where they're going to be persecuting, and they already have persecuted non-Haredim. If you know the state of Israel now, Haredim can't live with non-Haredim. They have to have their own towns, their own settlements, and they're not tolerant. So I don't think it would be right, you know, right if Rav Yoshev in his situation right now to have such a post. But that's what's going to, and yes, you can, I know Yiddish to read. It's not a problem reading it. So. Just go to the Sfarim blog. You'll see it. Thank you. Oh, so let me just conclude by thanking everyone again. I thank you for all that you have taught me. Almost every one of you have made comments or emailed me, many of you, and I've learned a great deal.